discussing this text, the Bodhicharya Avatara, or the Bodhisattva's way of life. His author is Shantideva. He was a monk in a big university in India. And in a way, this text, you could say it's his instructions to himself, as well as to us. And he covers what we call, among other things, it covers what we call the six paramitas, which are sometimes called the six perfections. But another way to translate that is the six means of transcendence, yeah? So the six ways of transcending ourselves. And they kind of come in pairs, these six. So we're on the second of a pair tonight. So last week we had Kshanti, which is patience, forbearance. And this week we've got Virya. So I'm going to explore, well, what does this word, what does this quality Virya mean? So it comes apparently from the same root as the English words virtue and also vigour and virility. So that's interesting. We'll start. So you've got connotations right from the beginning, both of energy with the vigour, but and with ethical excellence, with the virtue. So it's sometimes, and this is a definition I like the best, defined as energy in pursuit of the good, or skillful effort. So we are going to start looking at the verses of Shantideva in a minute, but we're going to just explore just a little bit what is meant by virya in general first. So sometimes it can be quite good to explore a quality by exploring its opposites. So what are the opposites of virya, of energy in pursuit of the good? This is an easy question.
Laziness.
Yeah? Laziness. Laziness, yeah, very good, yeah. Was there another one? Did two people say laziness?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably the kind of main opposite. Would you pop that up for me on the flip chart? So laziness, sloth, torpor. Yeah. So they're the opposites. So sometimes when we talk about the opposites of a quality in Buddhism, we talk about it in terms of the far enemy. I quite like that notion of the far enemy, because it also gives us a notion of the near enemy. So this is where it gets a bit interesting, I think. So the near enemy, the far enemy is obvious because it's the exact opposite. The near enemy is not so obvious. It's a bit sneaky because it can be something that masquerades as the real thing. So what might be a near enemy of virya?
Yeah. Distraction.
Distraction?
Distraction with unskillful things.
Okay, yeah, distraction with unskillful things, yeah.
Procrastination.
Procrastination, yeah. Do you think that's a near enemy or a far enemy? Is it a near enemy, something that's very like the real thing? I think that might be it. It's a good answer. I think it's a far enemy because it's the opposite. So a near enemy is something you might mistake for energy in pursuit of the good.
Like being busy all the time.
Yeah. Mm. Being busy all the time, yeah.
So the busyness, but that might be, it could be virya, that might be positive, but it might just be using up a lot of energy.
Okay.
In an unproductive way or in a sort of negative way.
Okay, so using energy in a negative way, unproductive way. Yeah, we got that. Anything else? Oh, sorry. What was that one?
Guilt.
Ah, guilt. Interesting. So, okay, so a sort of activity out of guilt, do you mean?
Yeah, I guess it could be considered far away, but also near in terms of your motivation for action.
Yeah, I think it could actually. I think if you could have a guilty motivation for action, that would be a near enemy. Yeah.
Maybe we could do the same thing with jealousy? Or?
So with Genesis, we'll say a little bit more.
Well, just more than.
Okay, so again, I sort of
having been driven.
Okay, I see what you mean. So being driven by guilt or jealousy, yeah, good, yeah.
Love could be. Love.
Love?
Yeah.
So.
Love, what is combined with unskillfulness?
Okay, so a sort of. Do you mean love or a kind of more neurotic attachment?
No, love for. Love. Love of good.
Okay.
Love to do good. Could be. If it's unskillfulness
could lead to. So why would love be unskillful? I'm just trying to understand what you mean.
If it's combined with unskillfulness, it could lead to the opposite.
So what would the unskillfulness be? Okay. One thing can start off skillful and turn unskillful. So an unhealthy. Again, it's a sort of unhealthy motivation for action.
Something like ambition, somewhat like jealousy,
being
driven to be better than someone else. To beat someone else.
It's
kind of jealousy, but it's.
No, I think that's. So I think all these. I think these are all good. So basically, what we've got. So the near enemies would have more to do with energy that's not in pursuit of the good. Yeah, that has got something unwholesome as its aim, like wanting to beat someone, you know, compete with them in an unhealthy way, or motivated by jealousy. It can be neurotic both in its ends, you know, once we might be very, very active, we might call it love, but actually what we're trying to do is get someone to love us, you know, so it might not be really caring for them. Or it can just almost be neurotic in itself, like, you know, the kind of classic workaholic thing where we feel that we're kind of trying to justify our existence, yeah, by rushing around doing good. Sangharaj just says somewhere that we can be, we can be addicted to doing good, you know, but it's that sort of doing good and that, it's almost like you do it to people, whether they want to or not, you know, so it's not taking the other person in, yeah? It hasn't got a view to this sort of higher purpose, to call it that. And interesting enough, there's another ancient teacher called Gampopa, who says normal worldly activity is in fact the greatest form of laziness. That's us going back to the far enemy, because it avoids the effort involved in sort of tackling the big issues of life. Yeah? So that's a bit about virya in general. And I think it's quite important to remember this, because, you know, though we're talking about vigour, virility and so on, it doesn't necessarily mean rushing around and doing stuff. I mean, it could mean being quite active in the world, but you could have a lot of virya, you know, you could be, I don't know, like lying ill in a hospital bed, and you could still be manifesting a lot of virya if you were working on your mental states and working at, you know, staying metaphor and practicing the other things. You know, you might be completely immobile, but still practicing virya. You might be very mobile, but actually not practicing virya. Yeah, so I think that's quite important. Yes?
I was thinking about energy in pursuit of the good.
Yeah.
And quite a big part of that energy is considering what the good is.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You say the same about love, I was thinking.
Yeah.
Blind faith.
Yeah.
That's
a really good point, isn't it? That ties in, yeah, and it ties in with that, the virtue aspect of it, doesn't it? And it ties in with wisdom of, you know, at the same time, you're trying to cultivate, none of these qualities, they're all kind of connected, you know. So another one of these paramitas is wisdom, so you've got to have that wisdom and consideration. Yeah. And it might be, you know, that can be on a grand scale, but it can be just as simple as, like, if you're trying to help someone, like actually taking them in, you know, what do they actually want and need, you know, not just what my idea of what would be good for them is, you know. Which, because it's, you know, we've all probably been on the receiving end of that, and actually it doesn't feel pleasant at all, does it? You know, you can't do things at people or to them. You've got to have that wisdom aspect. So, okay, so I think that's the background. I'm sure actually we could spend a whole evening talking about that. But let's go on to the text, because there's some juicy bits in the text, aren't they? We'll never get through it all. It's quite long, but let's see how we go. So I'll just go sort of verse by verse. So Shantideva starts off, this is a text I read you, talking about the importance of virya, really. He says, as well as cultivating kshanti, we should cultivate virya, because awakening or enlightenment requires that too. He says, we can't gain merit without virya any more than a boat can sail without the wind. So basically, and he says this with each of them as he goes through them, he starts off by saying, well, why is it essential for the Dharma life? Yeah. So do we agree with this? Do we agree that we need virya to make spiritual progress?
I guess in the sense that we need action.
Yeah, we need action. What kind of action do we need?
Well, in the opposite to laziness or
apathy
or not acting.
Good
action.
Yeah, we do. And I think especially at this stage of our spiritual life, that what we're taught is that if we do keep practicing, like eventually skillful action will become second nature. So in a way it would just be spontaneous. But for most of us, well certainly for myself, most of the time, skillful action, generous action, kind action and so on, isn't second nature. You know, I mean, on a good day it might be a little bit, but most of the time, you know, I'm having to make an effort to kind of overcome less skillful tendencies, yeah. And so that's where it's that kind of virya that's kind of going, oh God, I don't really exactly feel like this, but come on, it's a better matter, you know, you can practice it. You know, I don't feel like, say, getting up and meditate. I mean, every morning I don't feel that. I don't leap out of bed going, hooray, like meditation time. You know, every morning there's that bit of, do I want to? You know, and there's just that bit. But, you know, but then, you know, it's video that gets you out of bed. If you are the sort of person that doesn't leap out of bed, and, you know, it's video that gets you out of bed and goes, come on, you know that it makes a difference, you know, you bring in your, you think, yeah, it has helped me to change, it will be good, you know. But there's to overcome resistance, you know. Yeah. Is that a familiar, do people sort of relate to that?
So the action, is it physical or is it psychological then? The action that is required, is it physical or psychological?
Both, I think. Well, for me, getting out of bed, it's both. There's the psychological want to do it, but there is the physical.
Isn't that the psychological? You've got to have the motivation.
So yeah. So there's, And so sometimes it might be more subtle, you know, it might be more of a mind. It might be the effort, you know, in a way, I suppose it is psychological, isn't it? If it's in your mind, like if my mind's just going round and round in an argument, it requires virya to say to myself, come on, Subhadramati, this isn't going to get you anywhere. Because it's very tempting, you know, well, I find a very tempting to go down that path of least resistance. So there's a virya that can take place in your own mind that might not be physical at all. Yes.
Is it a bit more subtle, it can work both ways.
Seems like when we sit for meditation,
yeah,
just taking that posture, taking that open posture, the strong posture.
Yeah, yeah.
That can...
Ah, yes, yeah.
That in itself, I can't remember who said it now, I read a really good quotation the other day. It's... You don't need to...
Yeah.
To sit and then take on a positive mental state, just getting in that position. Yeah.
Yeah.
It helps in itself.
It does, doesn't it? I think
it's
that's
not necessarily that you have to think that it's the mind and the body.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point, isn't it? And even I was thinking getting yourself to the centre and then the shrine room and the first, actually that then starts to do it for you, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah, that you've got yourself in, as you say, adopting the posture. Yeah, so I think it's, you'd be hard placed to say what comes first, you know. But the main thing is, in a way, to just do something, yeah?
Is the main component of yoga, like, being courageous?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the kind of feeling of the world, a word kind of like just being guarded, basically, just going for it, having courage?
Yeah, I think bringing in, I think that is, and especially you've got that, that seems to come in with the vigour and virility, that there's some, yeah, there is courage, yeah. And again, that can be within our own mind, you know, it can be courageous to go, right, I'm not going to go down that track, I'm going to actually do something new, you know, because it's in a way, it's, the familiar will always feel safe, even if it's painful, so it always takes courage to break out into some new way of being.
Does it mean having also a dignifying attitude? Or?
Yes, exactly, yeah. I think that comes out in the reading later when he's talking about being like a lion, you know, and being like, yeah, being, it's almost like having that dignified attitude and being like a son or daughter of the Buddha. It's almost like if we could really relate to that, we naturally would be more skillful, because it would almost be in the most positive way sort of beneath us to, we'd want to live up to that. It would be beneath us to act unskillfully. We're adopting that dignified, positive pride. It's interesting, I'm sort of skipping ahead a bit here, but since you brought it up, I think what he's doing later in the text is he's using the very things that could be negative, like pride and desire and so on, for positive ends. He's saying, okay, instead of thinking of, oh, I mustn't be proud, that's not very Buddhist. He's saying, okay, use your pride to a good end. Be proud of being a son of the Buddha, you know, be proud of being a skillful person, be dignified, be almost like that warrior, you know, that would be beneath them to act in a sort of mean, debased sort of way. Yeah, I think that's great to bring that out. Yes.
In what you just read, was it likening the variant? I got the impression it was likening the variant to the wind. It was a case of like putting up the sail and then the wind.
Yeah. Well, it is, and I mean, again, we're kind of a little bit going ahead, but that would be maybe. I mean, I don't know. Maybe at our level, the variant is putting the sail up, and then which will take effort, but eventually. The wind will just take us along, but that we probably, most of us are still at the level of making sure the sail's up.
Yeah, so that's sort of how I interpret it. Is that
yeah.
Your effort is to put the sail up,
yeah.
and then that will allow Buddha to kind of the energy that's there to take you along. You know? Instead of like,
yeah.
I don't know, you think you get caught in like, oh, I have to be full of virya, I have to be virya, yeah. I have to be energetic. Well, it's just there if you can just get yourself into the, you know, allow it to flow. Kind
of thing. Yeah, but I think getting that sail up is quite hard work for most of us, can you? That's the thing. I think we've got to be a little bit careful. I think you're right that if we can get the sail up, the wind will take us. And definitely at the level, you know, you talk about the sort of spontaneous action of a Buddha where the wind would, and he's even got that at the end. But remember, this comes at the very end. At the very, very end, he says, as cotton is blown by the wind, we should be blown along by our enthusiastic desire to practice the Dharma. But like speaking for myself, I'm not there yet. I'm definitely still putting the sail up. Because I don't know about sailing. What happens if you don't have the sail fully up and the wind's blowing? You probably I don't know, who knows about sailing? It doesn't sound very good anyway.
Go
what's that?
You don't go anywhere.
You don't go anywhere, or you go aground or something, backwards. I'm sure happens. Yeah. So I think we've got to be, I think you are right, can you? But I think also you've got to be careful not to be premature in like this wind taking you along. I think I would argue for that we, most of us have to make a lot of effort of a particular, but that effort might be quite subtle, and then you can catch the wind, you know. And especially if you make, well, for example, if you make the effort, say, just to plug retreats a bit more, to get on retreat, then there will be a sort of wind, you will be taken along by the momentum of the retreat. So, some putting yourself in good conditions, there might be an effort to put yourself in good conditions that then helps you, but then you. You've got to just be a little bit careful you don't rest on your laurels, to mix the metaphors, you know. Yeah? A few more points, yeah? So, well, we can maybe. Sorry.
Yeah. I was just going to say, perhaps take that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's about just catching whatever wind is available. Oh. If it's a weak wind, if it's a strong wind. But being aware of that and being able to, you know, take whatever there is to maybe lead you into from a weak wind into a stronger wind. Maybe that's
yes. I'm a bit. I'm just a bit worried that you could be the wrong wind or something. Maybe because, like, so I've got. Hang on, I've got another little line up here. I think, well, maybe I'll just say a little bit before I come on, because I've got a little bit written down here. Then I'll come on to you too, because I think. So I think maybe, perhaps, I'm guessing that maybe that where a couple of people are coming from is that there can be a... Well, what's the... what the danger of all this energy stuff, and this is a guess, is that it can become a bit willful in the negative way. It can become a bit forced effort, yeah? That we have to have receptivity as well. So that's maybe where the wind being receptive to the wind comes in. So I think possibly we're right to be cautious, if I'm guessing correctly, against a kind of willful effort. Well, I'm using willful in the sort of pejorative sense, where we're forcing and kind of thinking, right, I've got to try harder. My spiritual life's not getting anywhere, right, up at 6 o'clock, up at 5 o'clock, up at 4 o'clock, right, I'm going to, like, kill myself, you know, which then always ends in a crash, you know, if it is willful. So I think we're right to be wary of that, but at the same time, well, actually, there's a little sense here that somebody, not myself, wrote, it says, it's the solution is to change willful effort to skillful effort, not to avoid making any effort at all. So we've got to watch we don't ricochet between that kind of unhelpful will, forcing ourselves unhelpfully, to then thinking, oh, right, I'm just going to, like, crash now and don't care. And you kind of see people doing this in their Dharma life. I'm sure I've done this myself. You kind of force too much and then you crash and you just don't do anything. So Sangharaksha is always emphasising to us the path of regular steps, which sounds easy, but actually it's the hardest of all, where we're just, yeah, that would be skillful effort. We're neither, like, pushing too hard to our own detriment, nor are we just thinking, oh, I'll just, like, sort of blow where the wind takes me, which, because it might not take you in the right place, you know. You've got to have some sort of wisdom about this. So I don't know if that helps in the discussion. I don't know if that's what people might be getting at. But I like that little phrase, change willful effort into skillful effort. So that might just be a little catchphrase to remember. And yes, for an advanced practitioner, you know, and this is held out as a promise to us in the sense, it will become more effortless in the sense that making the effort will be easy. Well, that's why later on he says, you know, he tries to say a bit like, say you were going to see your lover, you know, that the effort to do that feels easy because you want to do it, because it's just, you know, you're sort of driven by your desire. So, you know, eventually the effort to practice the Dharma might be like, you know, it can be as attractive to us as going to see a lover or going to do something we really love doing. There is still effort, but we want to make the effort because you know, it just, in that sense, it feels effortless. That's what we're eventually, if we keep practicing, will happen. But most of us, certainly myself included, isn't at that stage. So, yeah, so then I definitely feel that I need to make that effort to get the sail up if we're using that. So is there anything more on that bit? Yeah, so let's, yeah.
Just in terms of that metaphor.
Yeah.
I see the virya as the wind, which is down to us.
Yeah.
And everything else is the current.
Yeah.
And so if you you don't, and the ship is your life.
Yeah.
So if you don't make an effort within your life to have to sail up, then your virya or your wind can never push your boat, and so you just get stuck in the current.
And in a way, he says that he's urging us. He's saying, "Well, you've got this life, you know. For heaven's sake, do something with it." In a sense, so he's definitely speaking in strong terms. But he is saying, "You'll never get this chance again." He repeats this every. You know, he's again and again repeating this, you know, you'll never get this chance again. So you could take that as your literal life. But again, he's encouraging us to reflect on that we are in positive conditions, even if our conditions aren't perfect. The fact we've all got ourselves here tonight, at the very least means we're healthy enough to get here. At the very least means, I don't know, we've got enough money to afford the tube fare to get here. At the very least it means we're in a country where, you know, we've got religious freedom to practice. At the very least, it means we've got at least enough, you know, we're not having to work, like, you know, so hard. I'm sure many of us work very hard, but we're not having to work the whole time just to feed ourselves and our kids, you know. So he's saying, reflect on that and don't waste that, you know, because you never know, that one small change and that could all be gone, you know, and I think it's quite hard to remember that, isn't it? It wouldn't take much, actually, for all that to come completely up to you. And he's saying, well, then where would you be, you know? Then how are you going to get on, like, with mindfulness and metta? If you, you know, if you find it hard enough just now, what are you going to do if your country's at war or somebody's saying, you know, you're doing this in fear of your life or you're, like, starving hungry or something, you know? Most of us would be really hard pushed to be positive and skillful in that. And you know, and it could, we probably think it might not happen, but, you know, it could quite easily. Or, you know, we could just get very ill or something like that. You know, we were talking about this the last few weeks, when, you know, obviously it's possible to practice then, but it's going to, you know, if you're in, we're in, like, a great deal of pain constantly, or you can, you like, walk or see or hear or something, you know. So that's what he's saying, yeah, you've got this boat of your life, you know, get on with it, he's saying. So I might move on a little bit. Because there's so much in this, actually. We should do a whole course just on one section, shouldn't we, really? So, okay, so there he's making this energetic effort. And then he's looking at the well, let's take them one at a time. So he's got laziness as his first enemy. So that's idleness, indulgence in sensual pleasures, and so on. And then, so then I think we could have an interesting little bit of a discussion on, well, what's the difference between laziness and, I don't know, just having a rest, in a sense, because we do need to, you know, we do need to relax, don't we? So, if you agree with that, I certainly agree with that, what's the difference between laziness and resting and or relaxing?
Maybe laziness is a thing about avoidance.
Okay,
maybe.
Trying to
in a way also avoid reality of what
to do. I think it is, actually.
That seems to be one of the main differences between just resting.
There's a sort of avoidance. So there can be something kind of conscious about resting, can't it? I remember once turning up on a retreat. A whole group of us turned up on a study retreat. And I remember the leader of the retreat really told us off. He said, he just basically looked at us and he said, look at you. He said, you're in a terrible state. He said, you all look exhausted. And he said, I'll tell you something. He said, I'd bet that you don't know how to relax properly. And I thought, and he introduced something that I've never forgotten, but although I don't always practice it. He said, you have to, he said something quite interesting. He said, you have to put a bit of effort into relaxing for it to be real relaxation. He said, you should work on trying to make your relaxing time something that nourishes you. So, you know, he meant things like listening to some decent music, reading something decent that will actually feed you, like, well, you know, for me that would be poetry or something. He said, what can happen is you let yourself get so tired that then you just blob out, and then you just do stuff that actually doesn't revive you or nourish you, you know. You kind of, well, I know myself, read just rubbish, you know, or watch rubbish TV, or, you know, just do things. Yeah, it's just like doing things that are quite mindless and they're not actually refreshing. Whereas if you put with a bit of effort, yeah, something about you can relax properly. I mean, it seems like a contradiction in terms, but yes, Darbhadra.
I think before you make the effort, you've got to have the awareness of what the problem is.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, you are going to go down alleys all the time.
Yeah, you go down the path of least resistance, don't you?
Yeah. So there's got to be the awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you've got to be aware and sort of know yourself a bit, I think. Know what your own path of least resistance is. Do people sort of, does that ring a bell with people? Mm. Yeah. Mm. It's so, it's quite good just to remind myself, actually, you know. I know Maitreya Banda, that's why that Life with Full Attention course from Maitreya Banda's book, if people haven't done it, I really recommend it. And he's got whole sections on that. And he says things like, if you're going on the underground, like, just take a little poetry book or something, you know, and then, you know, then you won't be so likely to just, like, pick up the metro or something, you know, which actually doesn't, well, my experience doesn't give me anything, you know. But, so it's not expecting you, it's almost like knowing yourself, not thinking, okay, I'll meditate or something, you know. So you might not, maybe somebody could, but actually, no, I probably will want something to read. It's like thinking a little bit and thinking, oh, why don't I take something half decent or even full decent, something that will actually uplift me. So it's that, I think that could all be things we could bring into that.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
Oh, do you know?
This business on the tube, if you say you're just taking something basically to occupy yourself.
Yeah.
You want to be able to just get on the tube and accept that you're on the tube amongst other people, possibly crowded, and just accept that that is the situation.
Well, yes, you ought to be, but yes, I think that's the interesting word, you ought to be, and maybe you can do a bad job, which is great, so that is the aim, but I know I can't. So I think that's the knowing yourself. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I mean, ideally, if we were enlightened, you know, well, we ought to be able to, I don't know, be tortured and not complain, you know. But actually, I know I also wouldn't be able to do that. So it's like taking steps on the way. I think that's, to me, that's part of knowing myself, of thinking, okay, I'd like to read something on a journey, make it uplifting. Yes, the aim is whatever, you know, like the Buddha could just sit happily without any distractions for like 3 days and three nights and be totally happy. One day I'd love to be like that, but in the meantime, it's saying, well, what are the steps, you know? Yeah. Yes.
Can resting be also maybe like not being afraid of emptiness or like not having any distraction or anything to kind of get you busy?
Well, it could be, but again, I think, you see, I think it's a similar thing. I'd want to be careful about taking this in steps. I mean, if I spend my whole day rushing around, like on my laptop, to suddenly go to right now, I'm going to just sit. And I'll need stages to take me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like people going on solitary retreat. I mean, yes, ideally you'd go to a sort of remote place, not of a phone or anything, and be completely at ease and comfortable, but, you know, for a month. But actually, I'd say try a weekend first and somewhere, you know, that's not too far away. You know, just take steps to this. Because I think if we do too much of, well, we should be able to do this, we'll get into that sort of ricocheting of, oh, actually, I can't do that, I'm a failure, I'm rubbish. And then you'll be back to, like, where's the crisps and where's the... You know, you'll just go back into your path of least resistance to take steps. Anyway, I'm going to move us on. Again, we could have a whole evening just on this. Okay. I can't decide whether to...
can I also say something about
yes.
that you said?
Yes.
I also think that, for example, yeah, the difference between sort of laziness and relaxation, in a way you could also see it as like relaxation being a way of seeing it could be like seeing beauty in everything that you're doing, whether it's frustrating or not, but then just appreciating it for what it is, or just finding the pleasure in it, and then sort of absorbing that, and laziness would instead be sort of retreating into whatever it is that's pleasurable, sort of stimuli.
Yeah. Well, it would be, I think, again, you're right, like, ultimately it would be, and I mean, that's beautiful, it would be very relaxing, wouldn't it, if we saw beauty in everything. I mean, personally speaking, that is an aim for me, but I'll need to take steps along the way to that, you know, and from, you know, so it's up to me then to find out what those steps would be. So I might find, you know, I might find a smaller step towards that, yeah. But yeah, that would be the aim. I mean, that would, if you were enlightened, that is how you see the world. That would, you would see the world with equanimity like that, yeah. I'm going to move this on. I'm going to actually skip a few verses. So we had the enemies of virya as laziness, attachment to the unskillful. Maybe I'll let that speak for itself, the attachment to unskillful. But I think, because I think these are interesting, discouragement and low self-esteem. So I just think that's very interesting to have them under the heading of laziness. And they might even be surprising to you that low self-esteem is seen as a form of laziness, that discouragement is seen as a form of laziness. So I want to...
It's a vicious circle, isn't it? What is laziness would mean... Eventually, to give
and
low self-esteem.
Mm. Yes, it would. Yeah, it is a vicious circle. So so I think what we'll talk about now is there a way to get us out of that into a virtuous cycle rather than a vicious circle? Because I think these, yeah. Let me read a little bit from the text, can you, before we come on to it, if you don't mind. I'll just I'll just remind us what Shanta Devi says. So he says, we should be freeing ourselves from despair by practicing the Dharma, not being defeatist, thinking, how could I possibly become awakened? The Buddha, whose words are truth, has said that even those who in the past lives were gnats, mosquitoes, wasps and worms have reached awakening by making the effort. So why shouldn't I, a human being who can tell the difference between the skillful and unskillful, attain awakening? So this is sort of directly addressing that sort of despair and low self-esteem. So,
wondering what the discouragement bit was? I didn't catch that.
Discouragement. When did I say that?
Low self-esteem, discouragement.
Oh yeah, discouragement. And yeah. Well, I guess thinking, how could I possibly become awakened? Or it's kind of, you know...
Discouraging yourself.
Like discouraging yourself, yes, I think that's what it means, yeah, discouraging yourself. So this is, so basically, and I think some of us might relate to this, that one reason why we don't make much effort is because we just don't believe we can make progress. You know, it's almost like we get caught into... Oh, why bother even starting? I'll never be enlightened. And we can have that with sort of more with other things in life, can't we? I was at my poetry class today, and it just still seems so difficult. And I thought, oh, there's so much to learn, and there's so much refinement. Being, you know, the teacher's very, very good, and she was talking about all these great poets. And I thought, I could feel that sort of, oh, I'll, you know, I'm already 50, you know, I've not even started yet. How am I ever going to, you know, I could feel just that moment of just, and I had to make a conscious effort to go, come on, Sabarimati, you could just enjoy this and enjoy it for learning. So, okay, you probably never will be Seamus Heaney, but, you know, come on, you can still enjoy this. So do people recognise that, that kind of discouragement? You think, oh, it's so far away, and allowing oneself to be put off by that? Yes.
I mean, do you think in this context he's saying discouragement and low self-esteem are, in effect, our choices?
Yeah, I think he is, yeah.
Rather than saying, oh,
yeah,
it suddenly just comes to me and I've got a little control over it.
Yeah.
So we can actually notice that and then push it back
or act against it. Yes, I think he is saying we've got choices, yeah. I think that's definitely true. So how would you act against it if you notice that?
Well, I think to really be try and be objective about it.
If you
do say to yourself, well, I'm not good enough to do this.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna get anywhere.
Yeah.
To say, well, really what are the facts?
Yeah. Yeah.
What have I achieved?
Brilliant.
What do I need to do next?
Yeah. Brilliant. I think
he's asking for that, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's excellent. And in a way, that was why I asked you to do that little exercise beforehand of thinking, what have I achieved? I mean, could most people think of at least one thing they had achieved? Yeah, well, that's great, isn't it? So I think you can let consciously reflect and think, okay, well, I have achieved something. So why would that not continue, for example? You know, and maybe even some of us have achieved things we thought we never would. You know, if there's some things I'm like, God, I'll never be able to stop smoking, or I'll never be able to get back into communication with that person, or, you know, I'll never be able to sit up in front of a class and talk to people. You know, I never thought I'd be sitting here, like, you know, talking and stuff. And actually you think, oh God, you know, actually, just a bit of reflection, think, well, if those things, you know, have come into being, you know, why could other sort of at the moment unimaginable things not kind of come into being? So I think that's a really good answer, just simply being objective, reflecting, and then setting sort of achievable goals. You know, just actually, you know, sometimes that idea of enlightenment can seem like this lofty thing. But you think, okay, well, maybe my goal will be I'll get up every morning and meditate this week, you know. My goal will be, yeah, I'll have the courage to, you know, maybe, you know, speak to that person I'm a bit afraid of, or whatever it is, you know. So, yeah.
To me, it sounds a lot like, at the moment, what we're trying to do is come up with rationalisations and thoughts and things to kind of steer our minds in a certain way. But I would have thought that when you're talking about energy and pursuit of the good, you're dealing with, like, emotions and things that you don't, they just can engulf you and things, you know, like,
yeah,
like energy is sort of, you can sort of try and direct that with your mind, but it's a hard thing to just direct with your thoughts and, oh, I'll do that, or I'll rationalise.
Yeah, no, brilliant. I think that's really very good to bring that in. And I think actually, this is what he's going, I think actually this is what he's bringing in. So maybe that's that sort of, I'll just kind of randomly skip ahead because we won't have time to do all this anyway. So I think Kinyut's rightly saying, yeah, we're not going to be able to do all this. I think reflection can help. But yeah, we're dealing with quite primal forces, actually. It is, basically, it's our actions are steered by our desires, yeah? So this is where he talks about what are called the four powers, yeah? And the first one is skillful desire or dharma chanda. And I think, can you, this is recognising, and all of us, this is recognising what you're saying. We've got to somehow, you know, we've all got desire which drives us, yeah? We're always driven by our desires. We're not driven by what we think is good ideas, no matter how good they are. We're driven by desires. And often those desires are for sense pleasures and stuff like that, or things like ambition and fame, and which is a kind of sense pleasure of the mind, isn't it? But what he's looking at, so what he says, Shantideva says, is because in the past I lacked Dharma Chandra, enthusiastic desire for the good, I find myself in samsara now. Shakyamuni has sung that Dharma Chandra is the root of all virtue, and the root of Dharma Chandra is reflecting on the results of karma. So actually he does bring in reflection again. So basically what he's saying is that to actually progress in the spiritual life, you've got to want this as much as you would want all these other things, like your brilliant job, material success, your dream partner, all these other things. So we have to actually develop and almost kind of convert that desire, actually both develop and convert it into desire for the skillful. And he says reflecting on the law of karma is the way to do this. But interesting enough, that reflection isn't sort of just coolly sitting and thinking about karma. He's reflecting on the consequences. And this is what he says. He says, the heart of a man or woman who does good brings over with joy, and he or she is welcomed wherever they go. So actually, it's reflecting in quite an emotional way, so you can reflect on, well, what did it feel like the last time I was unskillful? You know, you can actually bring that to mind. I probably felt like rotten. You know, you probably, if you bring to mind the last time you were mean or unkind, you probably will notice that you felt, you know, there might have been an initial exhilaration as you kind of gave them what for, but actually you'll feel, you know, pained, you'll feel like disconnected. So it's like trying to, yes, reflect with your mind, but reflect sort of emotionally. What does it feel like to act skillfully? What does it feel like to act unskillfully? So he says, and then, you know, in a way he's kind of trying to frighten us about it. He says the unskillful person will scream in agony as the skin is torn away by the Lord of Death. So this isn't the kind of the punishment of hell. It gives a sense. This isn't the punishment of hell in a sort of Christian or kind of theistic sense. It's the natural consequences. So the more unskillful we are, the more we'll be afraid of death as a natural consequence. So you could, if that doesn't kind of cut the mustard for us in a sense, we can more just think, well, what happens? What happens to me if I go around being hateful, being irritable? You know, all that, usually what it means is people don't like us very much, we get a bit paranoid. In a way, we can use that as a metaphor as well as kind of literally. It probably does mean when we come to death, we will be more fearful because we'll have, you know, we won't be at peace with ourselves. You know, that's what it means. Using that Lord of Death is, you know, we can use that metaphorically there. So it is reflecting, but reflecting in an emotional way. Do you see what I mean? And that, we'll need to do that, or else we'll never turn our desire, we won't turn our desire in that way. So are there any other way? Oh, sorry, you had a question.
I said I didn't understand that.
Okay, yeah. So that's what it means. It means reflecting on the natural consequences of our skillful and unskillful actions, but really doing that. Really feeling the pain of being unskillful and really feeling the joy of the clear conscience, actually. Allowing ourselves to just experience the joy of that. You know, sometimes I've noticed that myself. I've been prone to being in quite a lot of arguments in my life, and every now and then I have this lovely feeling of, oh, gosh, you know, I'm going to this meeting and I'm not at odds with anyone. Oh, great, what a relief, you know. It's just, and there is an actual joy of that, and I think it's worth, no, it's not so much in a sort of blowing your own trumpet kind of way, but just think, God, actually, that relief feels brilliant. So better if you remember that. Remember how good this feels the next time you're tempted to just get into a spat just for the sake of it, you know. So it's really, you know, that's what I mean by reflecting on that quite emotional way. So is there any other ways we can kind of convert our kind of karma chanda, that's desire for sense pleasure, to dharma chanda? There's reflection.
Mm.
It's interesting though, you know, I think an interesting point is we're not trying to get, it's not so much trying to get rid of desire. Sometimes when we first hear about Buddhism, it can sound like we're trying to get rid of desire and get rid of like da da da. But actually, this is a much better way to look at it. You're trying to convert the object of your desire into the skillful. So you desire the well-being of all beings. So it's a transformation of that desire from objects that can't satisfy it. Yes?
Well, sometimes the way the wind goes, sometimes the way life goes, that actually forces you to take that choice. And taking that choice also changes your desire.
Mm-hmm.
So being aware, of course, of the path itself, that you, if you're lucky enough in life and you found already the path, so being aware of it, that will, of course, help you. But, it's basically the circumstances in life that would perhaps push you to the path and change your desire, basically.
Well, it can be the circumstances of life in a way, but I suppose what we're trying to do is have something that comes from within ourselves, so no matter what those winds blow to us, we can still have that strength in itself to have that choice and responsiveness. I mean, that won't happen all at once. We've got to practice. And practice, you know, it's good to practice in small ways with just, again, Shantideva's always on about that. We're talking about this last week. You practice with, like, the smaller circumstances of life almost to build that muscle up. You know, so you practice with minor discomforts and minor difficulties so that even if you have major ones, you're aware of that choice, that you will choose the skillful even in the more and more difficult circumstances. It's more difficult to choose the skillful the more sort of oppressed we are by circumstances of life, but it's not impossible. And the more we practice now, in a sense, the more we'll be developing that. So it also talks about, so in these four powers, there's self-confidence and skillful pride. That, this might tie in with the dignity that you said. So again, this is, I think also this reflection on where we have had success can be good here, yeah? So we can sort of almost strengthen that habit of success by reflecting on our successes, especially our successes in our Dharma life. You know, we think, oh, well, actually, it's almost, because sometimes it can just be a habit of mine to think, oh, I'm a bit rubbish and I'm not good at this, but we could actually say, oh, well, you know, this was a success and this, and I've changed this. And again, that will have an emotional effect on us. And again, this is, he's been very kind of clever in a way, Shantideva, because he's transforming what could be a negative quality, like a sort of unskillful pride, into a positive pride. So unskillful pride would be, well, that would be pride at the expense of other people, wouldn't it? It would be setting yourself up above people. That would obviously be unskillful, but skillful pride is that kind of Buddha pride, that pride, well, in being, I like that notion of being a son or a daughter of the Buddha. You know, you wouldn't want to let your family down, in a sense. So it's like living up to that. Yeah?
Is skillful and pride, possibly a dignity or kind of higher self-esteem, self, I'm just trying to see what the difference is, you know, between skillful pride and skillful.
Mm-hmm. I think dignity is quite a good word for it. That would be skillful pride, would be dignity. I think what would make it unskillful is it like, definitely if it's an expense of other people, or if it's, I suppose if it's trying to conceal an actual lack or something, that would be it, wouldn't it, in yourself? If it's trying, if it's not sort of out just of a fullness, if it's trying to, it's like a shell then of actually, we actually have got this lack or this gap, but we're trying to bolster ourselves up. So that's where self-meta would be really important in developing for it, because with self-meta, the more self-meta we've got, the less we're trying to falsely bolster ourselves up. So self-meta would be a practice for that. And yeah, also traditionally acting ethically, if we've got nothing, you know, if we haven't got something on our conscience, then we can just take a positive, that will make us feel that dignity, you know. Whereas often the opposite is true. If we have got something on our conscience, we'll tend to feel diminished, and then we'll be tempted to do something to cover that up, and that would be unskillful pride.
Would you also say, for example, the skillful pride, sort of relate that to confidence that's real and concrete? Would you say that's
Yeah, so I'm sure that's true. So what would confidence that's real and concrete be?
It's not something that's backed up by something that's physical or just something that you could use in the real world, but something that's more sort of got some truth in you.
Yeah. So something that's real, and ultimately, as Buddhists, that would be, well, what we can take confidence in, for example, is that the Buddha said it's possible for any human being to grow and develop and be fulfilled all the way to enlightenment. So we can take confidence in that. Like, I love those lines, many of you know, in the Threefold Puja, the Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can overcome. So, for example, we can take confidence in that. So and sometimes, because sometimes it's hard to completely do it for ourselves, so we can give each other confidence, and we can take confidence from the way other people see us. I know when I first came along to the Buddha Center, I remember actually using this phrase to myself. My thought in my mind was, oh, the people here believe in me more than I believe in myself. Yeah, so there was this lovely sense of I felt like, yeah, people believed in me. People thought I could do things. People thought I could, you know, thought I was sort of more than I thought myself was. So I think we can, you know, it can be, like it can be sort of generated from outsiders, or it can be sparked off from outsiders, or from the Buddha, from the Sangha. Okay, great. And then this will be the last one, I think, because I've just noticed the time.
Just on this sort of topic of confidence and skillfulness, I think there's sort of kind of follows on from what I said before. There's honesty and objectivity in this whole approach, and I think, thinking about confidence, I know I can sometimes go into a meeting more confidently by admitting what I don't know.
Yeah.
Rather than going in.
Yeah, with swagger, yes.
I know it all.
I think that's really good, isn't it? And it's that thing of, like, fearlessness doesn't mean that we never feel fear in a way. It's sort of almost, I think that's a good one to end on, that it's about sort of honesty, and it takes that, to me, that ties in with self-meta, because I think the more meta we have for ourselves, the more just honest we can be about who we are. We don't need to pretend.
To be dishonest would be very unskillful, I think.
Yes, in the sense that it would cause ourselves harm, wouldn't it? We'd get into that vicious.
To be dishonest with yourself.
It's
such a bad starting point.
Isn't it?
Dishonest with everyone.
Good. Okay, I think we're going to have to end it there, but thank you all for a very, very interesting discussion. And next week we've got Jnanavacha, have we? On Pranya? On Pranya wisdom. Yeah. Jnanavacha back to the class after an absence of, he's been on a lot of retreats. So see you next week. It'll be a good one, I'm sure. Thank you. Great.